My mornings are chaos. I need coffee that works as hard as I do. That's why I drink Everyday Dose, coffee with benefits. It's rich, delicious coffee boosted with mushrooms, collagen, and nootropics. Everything I need for focus and balance, ready in 30 seconds. The Black Friday sale is on. Get 61% off your first coffee plus starter kit, a free A2 probiotic creamer, and over $100 in free gifts. Plus, enter for a chance to win $100 cash or get your entire order refunded. Visit everydaydose.com/podcast or use code podcast at checkout.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Chapter 6 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Cholmondeley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 6. After the glare and the noise, the shrill blasts of penny trumpets, and the sustained beating of penny drums, the silence of the slumberly woods was delightful to Ruth. The comparative silence, that is to say, for where Molly was, absolute silence need never be feared. Long before the first gate had been reached, Balsam had, of course, returned to the mode of procedure which suited him and his race best, and it was only when the road inclined to be downhill that he could be urged into anything like a trot. "Never mind," said Molly, consolingly to Ruth, as he finally settled into a slow lounge, gracefully waving his ears and tail at the army of flies which accompanied him. "When we get to the place where the firs are, and the road goes between the rocks, it's downhill all the way, and we'll gallop down." But it was a long way to the firs, and Ruth was in no hurry. It was an ideal afternoon, verging towards evening, an afternoon of golden lights and broken shadows, of vivid greens in shady places. It must have been on such a day as this, Ruth thought, that the Almighty walked in the Garden of Eden when the sun was low, while as yet the Tree of Knowledge was but in blossom, while as yet autumn and its apples were far off, long before fig leaves and millinery were thought of. On either side the bracken and the lady fern grew thick and high, almost overlapping the broad moss-grown path, across which the young rabbits popped away in their new brown coats, showing their little white linings in their lazy haste. A dog rose had hung out a whole constellation of pale stars for Molly to catch at as they passed. A family of honeysuckles clung, faint and sweet, just beyond the reach of the little hand that stretched after them in turn. They had reached the top of an ascent that would have been level to anything but the mean spirit of a donkey, when Molly gave a start.
"Cousin Ruth, there's something creepy among the trees. Don't you hear it? Ho!"
There was a movement in the bracken, which grew too thick and high to allow of anything being easily seen at a little distance.
"If it's a lion," said Molly in a faint whisper, "and I feel in my heart it is, he must have Barnum."
Barnum at this moment pricked his large ears, and Molly and Ruth both heard the snapping of a twig, and saw a figure slip behind a tree. Molly's spirits rose, and Ruth's went down in proportion. The woods were lonely, and they were nearing the most lonely part. "It's only a man," said Ruth, rather sharply. "I expect it is one of the keepers." "Oh, Ruth!" "Come, Molly, we shall never get home at this rate. Whip up Barnum, and let us trot down the hill." Much relieved about Barnum's immediate future, Molly incited him to a really noble trot, and did not allow him to relapse even on the flat which followed. Through the rattling and the jolting, however, Ruth could still hear a stealthy rustle in the fern and underwood. The man was following them.
"He's coming after us," whispered Molly, with round, frightened eyes, "and Barnum will stop in a minute, I know. Oh, Cousin Ruth, what shall we do?"
Ruth hesitated. They were nearing the steep pitch where the firs overhung the road, which was cut out between huge boulders of rock and sandstone. The ground rose rough and precipitous on their right, and fell away to their left. Just over the brow of the hill, out of sight, was, as she well knew, the second gate. The noise in the brushwood had ceased. Turning suddenly, her quick eye just caught sight of a figure disappearing behind the slope of the falling ground to the left. He was a lame man, and he was running. In a moment she saw that he was making a short cut, with the intention of waylaying them at the gate. He would get there long before they would, and even then Barnum was beginning the ascent, which really was an ascent this time, at his slowest walk. Molly's teeth were chattering in her little head. "Now, Molly," said Ruth sharply, "listen to me, and don't be a baby. He'll wait for us at the gate, so he can't see us here. Get out this moment, and we will both run up the hill to the keeper's cottage at the top of the bank. We shall get there first, because he is lame." They had passed the bracken now, and were among the moss and sandstone beneath the firs. Ruth hastily dragged Molly out of the cart without stopping Barnum, who proceeded, twirling his ears, leisurely, without them.
"Oh, my poor Barnum!"
sobbed Molly, with a backward glance at that unconscious favourite marching towards its doom. "There's no time to think of poor Barnum now," replied Ruth. "Run on in front of me, and don't step on anything crackly." "Never in this world," thought Ruth, "will I come alone here with Molly again. Never again will I—" But it was stiff climbing, and the remainder of the resolution was lost. They are high to the right above the white gate now. The keeper's cottage is in sight, built against a ledge of rock, up to which wide rough steps have been cut in the sandstone. Ruth looks down at the gate below. He is waiting. The dreadful man is waiting there, as she expected. And Barnum, toying with a fern, is at that moment coming round the corner. She sees that he takes in the situation instantly. There is but one way in which they can have fled, and he knows it. In a moment he comes halting and pounding up the slope. He sees their white dresses among the firs. "Run, Molly, run, Ruth, spare no expense. If your new black sash catches in the briars, let it catch." He did not, for he is making wonderful play with that lame leg up the hill. It's an even race. Now for the stone steps. How many more are there than there ever were before? Quick, through the wicket, and up through the little kitchen garden. Molly is at the door first, beating upon it, and calling wildly on the name of Brown. And then Ruth's heart turns sick within her. The door is locked. Through the window, which usually blossoms with geraniums, she could see the black fireplace and the bare walls. No Brown within answers to Molly's cries. Brown has been turned away for drinking. Mrs. Brown, who hung a slender wash on the hedge only last week, has departed with her lord. Brown's cottage is tenantless. The pursuer must have known it when he breasted the hill. A mixed sound as of swearing and stumbling comes from the direction of the stone steps. The pursuer is evidently intoxicated, probably lunatic. "Quick, Molly," gasps Ruth, "round by the back, and then cut down towards the young plantation, and make for the road again. Don't stop for me." The little yard, the pigsty, the water butt fly past. Past fly the empty kennels. Past does not fly the other gate. Locked, padlocked. It's like a bad dream. Molly, with a windmill-like exhibition of black legs, gives Ruth a lead over. "Now for it, Ruth. The bars are close together, and the gate is high. It's not a time to stick at trifles. What does it matter if you can get over best by assuming a masculine equestrian attitude for a moment on the top bar? There. And now down the hill again, away to your left. Take to your heels, and be thankful they are not high ones. Never mind if your hair is coming down. You have a thousand good qualities, Ruth, high principles and a tender conscience, but you are not a swift runner, and you've not played Sally Water all day for nothing." Molly is far in front now. A heavy trampling is not far behind. Nay, it is closer than you thought. And your eyes are becoming misty, Ruth, and armies of drums are beating every other sound out of your ears. That shouting behind you, for instance. The intoxicated, murderous lunatic is close behind. 1 minute. 2 minutes. How many more seconds can you keep it up? Through the young plantation, down the hill, into the sandy road again. The sandy uphill road. How much longer can you keep it up? Charles strolled quietly homeward, enjoying the beauties of nature, and reflecting on the quantity of rabbit shooting that Mr. Thursby must enjoy. He may also have mused on Lady Grace, for anything that can be known to the contrary, and have possibly made a mental note that if it had been she whom he had asked to walk home with him, instead of Ruth, he would not have been alone at that moment. Be that as it may, he leisurely pursued his path, until a fallen tree beside the bank looked so inviting that, Evelyn and Ralph having gone out to friends at a distance, Charles, who was in no hurry to return to Lady Mary, seated himself thereon, with a cigarette to bear him company. To him, with rent garments and dust upon her head, and indeed all over her, suddenly appeared Molly. Molly, white with panic, breathless, unable to articulate, pointing in the direction from which she had come. In a moment, Charles was tearing down the road at full speed. A tall, swaying figure almost ran against him at the first turn, and Ruth only avoided him to collapse suddenly in the dry ditch, her face in the bank, and a yard of sash biting the dust along the road behind her. Her pursuer stopped short. Charles made a step towards him and stopped short also. The two men stood and looked at each other without speaking. When Ruth found herself in a position to make observations, she discovered that she was sitting by the roadside with her head resting against, was it a tweed arm or the bank? She moved a little and found that first impressions are apt to prove misleading. It was the bank. She opened her eyes to see a brown, red-lined hat on the ground beside her, half full of water, through which she could dimly discern the golden submerged name of the maker. She seemed to have been contemplating it with vague interest for about an hour, when she became aware that someone was dabbing her forehead with a wet silk handkerchief. "Better?" asked Charles's voice. "Oh!" gasped Ruth, suddenly trying to sit up, but finding the attempt resulted only in the partial movement of a finger somewhere in the distance.
"Have I really? Surely, I was not so abject as to faint."
"Truth," said Charles, with a reassured look in his quick, anxious eyes, "obliges me to say you did." "I thought better of myself than that." "Pride goes before a fall, or a faint."
"Oh dear," turning paler than ever. "Where's Molly?"
"She's all right," said Charles hastily, applying the pocket handkerchief again. "Don't alarm yourself, and pray don't try to get up. You can see just as much of the view sitting down. Molly has gone for the donkey cart."
"And that dreadful man?"
"That dreadful man has also departed.
By the way, did you see his face? Would you know him again if the policeman succeeds in finding him?" "No, I never really looked round. I only saw, when he began to run to cut us off at the gate, that he was lame."
"Ah," said Charles reflectively, then more briskly with a new access of dabbing. "How is the faintness going on?"
"Capitally," replied Ruth, with a faint, amused smile. "But if it does not seem ungrateful, I should be very thankful if I might be spared the rest of the water in the hat, or if it might be poured over me at once, if you don't wish it to be wasted."
"Oh, have I done too much? I imagined my services were invaluable. Let me help you to find your own handkerchief, if you would like a dry one for a change. Ah, what a good shot into that labyrinth of drapery. You find it for yourself. You are certainly better."
"But my self-respect," replied Ruth, drying her face, "is gone forever."
"I lost mine years ago," said Charles, carefully dusting Ruth's hat, "but I got over it. I had no idea those bows were supported by a wire inside. One lives and learns."
"I never did such a thing before," continued Ruth ruefully.
"I've always felt a sort of contempt for girls who scream or faint just when they ought not." "For my part, I'm glad to perceive you have some little feminine weakness. Your growing solicitude, also, as to the state of your back hair, is pleasing in the extreme."
"I'm too confused and shaken to retaliate just now. You're quite right to make hay while the sun shines. But when I am myself again, beware."
"And your gown," continued Charles. "What a yawning gulfs, what chasms appear, and what a quantity of extraneous matter you have brought away with you. Reminiscences of travel, burrs, very perfect specimens of burrs, thistledown, chips of fur, several complete spiders' webs, and your sash, which seems to have a particularly adhesive fringe, is a museum in itself. Ah, here comes that card of little cowards, Molly, with Barnum and the donkey-cart." Molly, who had left Ruth for dead, greeted her cousin with a transport of affection, and then proceeded to recount the fearful risks that Barnum had encountered by being deserted, and the stoic calm with which he had waited for them at the gate.
"He's not a common donkey," she said with pride. "Get in, Ruth. Are you coming in, Uncle Charles? There's just room for you to squeeze in between Ruth and me, isn't there, Ruth? You're not going to walk beside, are you?"
But Charles was determined not to let them out of his sight again, and he walked beside them the remainder of the way to Atherston. He remained silent and preoccupied during the evening which followed, pored over a newspaper, and went off to his room early, leaving Ralph dozing in the smoking-room. It was a fine, moonlight night, still and clear. He stood at the open window looking out for a few minutes, and then began fumbling in a dilapidated old travel-bag such as only rich men use. "Not much," he said to himself, spreading out a few sovereigns and some silver on the table. "But it will do." He put the money in his pocket, took off his gold hunting watch, and then went back to the smoking-room. "I'm going out again, Ralph, as I did last night. If I come in late, you need not take me for a burglar." Ralph murmured something unintelligible, and Charles ran downstairs and let himself out of the drawing-room French window, that long French window to the ground, which Evelyn had taken a fancy to in her neighbour's drawing-room, and which she could never be made to see was not in keeping with the character of her old black-and-white house. He put the shutter back after he had passed through, and carefully drawing the window to behind him, without actually closing it. He took a turn or two upon the bowling green, and then walked off in the direction of the Slumberly Woods. After a lapse of an hour or more, he returned as quietly as he had gone, let himself in, made all secure, and stole up to his room. End of chapter 6.
Chapter 7 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Chumley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 7. Vandam was considered by many people to be the most beautiful house in Buckshire. In these days of great brand-new imitation of intensely old houses, where the amount of ground covered measures the purse of the builder, it is pleasant to come upon a place like Vandam, a quiet old manor house, neither large nor small, built of ancient bricks, blent to a dim purple and a dim red by that subtle craftsman, time. Whoever, in the years that were no more, had chosen the place whereon to build, had chosen well. Vandam stood on the slope of a gentle hill, looking across a sweep of green valley to the rising woods beyond, which in days gone had been a Roman camp, and where the curious might still trace the wide ledges cut among the regular lines of the trees. Some careful hand had planned the hanging gardens in front of the house, which fell away to the stream below. Flights of wide stone steps led down from terrace to terrace, each built up by its south wall, covered with a wealth of jasmine and ivy and climbing roses. But all was wild and deserted now. Weeds had started up between the stone slabs of the steps, and the roses blossomed out sweet and profuse, for it was the time of roses amid convolvulus and campion. The quaint old dovecote near the house had almost disappeared behind the trees that had crowded up round it, and held aloft its weathercock in silent protest at their encroachment. The stables, close at hand, with their worn-out clock and silent bell, were tenantless. The coach-houses were full of useless old chariots and carriages. In one splendid court-coach, the pigeons had found their way through an open window and had made nests, somewhat to the detriment of the green and white satin fittings. Great cedars, bent beneath the weight of years, grew round the house. The patriarch among them had let fall one of its gnarled, supplicating arms in the winter, and there it still lay where it had fallen. Anything more out of keeping with the dignified old place than its owner could hardly be imagined, as he stood in his eternal light grey suit, with a badge of affliction lightly borne on his left arm, looking at his heritage with his cropped head a little on one side. The sun was shining, but like a smile on a serious face, Vandam caught the light on all its shuttered windows, and remained grave, looking out across its terraces to the forest. "It were but a villa on the Mediterranean, or a house in London," he said to himself. "But I have no chance." And he shrugged his shoulders and wandered back into the house again. But if the outside oppressed him, the interior was not calculated to raise his spirits. Dare had an elegant taste, which he had never hitherto been able to gratify, for blue satin, furniture, and gilding, for large mirrors and painted ceilings of lovers and cupids, and similar small deer. The old square hall at Vandam, with its great stained glass windows, representing the various quarterings of the Dare arms, about which he knew nothing and cared less, oppressed him. So did the black polished oak floor, and the walls with their white bas-reliefs of twisting wreaths and scrolls, with busts at intervals of Cicero and Dante, and other severe and melancholy personages. The rapiers upon the high white chimney-piece were more to his taste. He had taken them down the first day after his arrival, and had stamped and cut and thrust in the most approved style, in the presence of Faust, the black poodle. Dare was not the kind of man to be touched by it, but to many minds there would have been something pathetic in seeing a house which had evidently been an object of the tender love and care of a bygone generation, going to rack and ruin from neglect. Careful hands had embroidered, in the fine exquisite work of former days, marvellous coverlets and hangings, which still adorned the long suites of empty bedrooms. Someone had taken an elaborate pleasure in fitting up those rooms, had put potpourri in tall oriental jars in the passages, had covered the old inlaid Dutch chairs with dim needlework. The Dare, who had lived at court, whose chariot was now the refuge of pigeons, whose court suits, with the tissue paper still in the sleeves, yet remained in one of the old oak chests, and whose jewelled sword still hung in the hall, and filled one of the rooms with engravings of the royal family and ministers of his day. The Dare, who had been an admiral, had left his miniature surrounded by prints of the naval engagements he had taken part in. And on the oak staircase a tattered flag still hung, a trophy of unremembered victory. But they were past and forgotten. The hands which had arranged their memorials with such pride and love had long since gone down to idleness and forgetfulness also. Who cared for the family legends now? They too had gone down into silence. There was no one to tell Dare that the old blue enamel bowl in the hall, in which he gave Faust refreshment, had been brought back from the loot of the winter palace of Peking, or that the drawers of the Reisner table in the drawing-room was full of treasured medals and miniatures, and that the key thereof was rusting in a silver patch-box on the writing-table. The unclamped boxes in the lumber-room kept the history to themselves of all the silver plate that had lived in them once upon a time, although the few odd pieces remaining hinted at the splendour of what had been. In one corner of the dining-room the mahogany tomb still stood of a great gold racing-cup, under the portrait of the horse that had won it. But the cup had followed the silver dinner-service, had followed the diamonds, had followed in the wake of a handsome fortune, leaving the after-generations impoverished. If their money is taken from them, some families are left poor indeed, and to this class the Dares belonged. It is curious to notice the occasional real equality underlying the apparent inequality of different conditions of life. The unconscious poverty, and even bankruptcy, of some rich people in every kind of wealth except money, affords an interesting study, and it seems doubly hard when those who have nothing to live upon, and be loved and respected for, except their money, have even that taken from them. As Dare wandered through the deserted rooms, the want of money of his predecessors, and consequently of himself, was borne in upon him. It fell like a shadow across his light, pleasure-loving soul. He had expected so much from this unlooked-for inheritance, and all he had found was a melancholy house with a past. He went aimlessly through the hall into the library. It was there that his uncle had lived, there that he had been found when death came to look for him, among the books which he had been unable to carry away with him at his departure. Rare old tomes and first editions, long shelves of dead authors, who, it is to be hoped, continue to write in other worlds for those who read their lives away in this. Old Mr. Dare's interests and affections had all been bound in morocco and vellum. A volume lay open on the table, where the old man had put it down beside the leather armchair where he had sat, with his back to the light, summer and winter, winter and summer, for so many years. No one had moved it since. A wavering pencil mark had scored the page here and there. Dare shut it up and replaced it among his brethren. How triste and silent the house seemed. He wondered what the old uncle had been like, and sauntered into the staircase hall, much in need of varnish, where the Dares that had gone before him lived. But these were too ancient to have his predecessor among them. He went into the long, oak-panelled dining-room, where above the high carved dado were more Dares. Perhaps that man with the book was his namesake, the departed Alfred Dare. He wondered vaguely how he should look when he also took his place among his relations. Nature had favoured him with a better moustache than most men, and he had a premonitory feeling that the very moustache itself, though undeniable in real life, would look out of keeping among these bluff, frank, light-haired people, for whom it seemed he would never be near them before, was a living representative. A sudden access of pleasurable dignity came over him as he sat on the dining-table, the great mahogany dining-table, which still showed vestiges of a bygone polish, and was heavily dented by long years of hammered applause. These ancestors of his, he would not disgrace them. A few minutes ago he had been wondering whether Vander might not be let. Now, with one of the rapid transitions habitual to him, he resolved that he would live at Vanden, that in all things he would be as they had been. He would become that vague, indefinable, to him, mythical personage, a country squire. Fortunately, he had a neat leg for a stocking. It was lost, so to speak, in his present mode of dress, but he felt that it would appear to advantage in the perpetual knickerbockers which he supposed it would be his lot to wear. It would also become his duty and his pleasure to marry. For those who tread in safety the slippery heights of married life, he felt a true esteem. It would be a strain, no doubt, a great effort, but at this moment he was capable of anything. The finger of duty was plain. And with that adorable Miss Ruth, with or without a fortune, alas, he trusted she had a fortune, for as he came to think thereon, he remembered that he was desperately poor. As far as he could make out from his agent, a grim, silent man who had taken an evident dislike to him from the first, there was no money anywhere. The rents would come in at Michaelmas, but the interest of heavy mortgages had to be paid, the estate had to be kept up. There was succession duty, there were debts, long outstanding debts, which came pouring in now, which Waters spread before him with an iron smile, and which poor Dare contemplated with his head on one side and solemn arched eyebrows. When Dare was not smiling, he was also preternaturally solemn. There was no happy medium in his face, or consequently in his mind, which was generally gay, but if not, was involved in a tragic gloom. "These bills, my friend," he would say at last, tapping them in deep dejection and raising his eyebrows into his hair, "how do we pay them?" But Waters did not know. How should he, Waters, know? Waters only knew that the farmers would want a reduction in these bad times. Mr. Dare might be sure of that. And what with arrears, and one thing and another, he could not expect more than two-thirds of his rents when they did arrive. Mr. Dare might lay his account for that. The only money which Dare received to carry on with, on his succession to the great honour and dignity of proprietor of Vanden, was brought to him by the old dairywoman of the house, a faithful creature, who produced out of an old stocking the actual coins which she had received for the butter and cheese she had sold, of which she showed Dare an account, chalked up in some dead language on the dairy door. She was a little doubled-up woman who had served the family all her life. Dare's ready smile and handsome face had won her heart before he had been many days at Vanden, in spite of his foreign ways, and he found himself constantly meeting her unexpectedly round corners, where she had been lying in wait for him, each time with a secret revelation to whisper respecting what she called the goings-on. "You're not telling me, sir, but it's only right you should know it's Mrs. Smith," the housekeeper, of whom Dare stood in mortal terror. "That's them fine damask tablecloths out for the housekeeper's room. I see them myself, and every one going in rag and ruin in the linen closet." Or, "Joseph have took in another flitch this very day, sir, as Mrs. Smith sent for, and the old flitch all cut to waste. Do go to look at the flitches, sir, and the abs. Then the room over the stables. And it's always butter, butter, butter in the kitchen, not a bit of dripping used. There's not a pot of dripping in the larder, or so much as a skin of lard. Where does it all go to? You ask Mrs. Smith, and how she sleeps in her bed at night, I don't know." Dare listened, nodded, made his escape, and did nothing. In the village it was as bad. Time, which had dealt so kindly with Vanden itself, had taken the straggling village in hand too. Nothing could be more picturesque than the crazy black and white houses, with lichen on their broken-in thatch, and the plaster peeling off from between the irregular beams of black wood. Nothing more picturesque, and nothing more miserable. When time puts in his burnt umbers and brown madders with a lavish hand, and introduces his beautiful irregularities of outline and his artistic disrepair, he does not look to the drainage, and takes no thought for holes in the roof. Dare could not go out without eager women sallying out of cottages as he passed, begging him just to come in and walk upstairs. They would say no more, "But would the new squire walk upstairs?" And Dare would stumble up and see enough to promise. Alas, how much he promised in those early days! And in the gloaming, heavy, dull-eyed men met him in the lanes coming back from their work, and followed him to "beg pardon, sir," and lay before the new squire things that would never reach him through Waters. Bitter things, small injustices, too trivial to seem worthy of mention, which served to widen the gulf between class and class. They looked to Dare to help them, to make the crooked straight, to begin a new regime. They looked to the new king to administer his little realm, the new king who, alas, cared for none of these things. And Dare promised that he would do what he could, and looked anxious and interested, and held out his brown hand and raised hopes. but he had no money. No money. He spoke to Waters at first, but he soon found that it was no good. The houses were bad? Of course they were bad. Cottage property did not pay. And would Mr. Dare kindly tell him where the money for repairing them was to come from? Perhaps Mr. Dare might like to put a little of his private fortune into the cottages and the drains and the new pumps. Dare winced. His fortune had not gone the time-honoured way of the fortunes of spirited young men of narrow means with souls above a sordid economy. But still, it had gone all the same, and in a manner he did not care to think of. It was after one of these depressing interviews with Waters that Ralph and Evelyn found the new owner of Vanden when they rode over together to call, a day or two after the school feast. Poor Dare was sitting on the low ivy-covered wall of the topmost terrace, a prey to the deepest dejection. If he had lived in Spartan days, when it was possible to conceal gnawing foxes under wearing apparel, he would have made no use of the advantages of Grecian dress for such a purpose. Captivated by Evelyn's gentleness and sympathetic manner, strangers always thought Evelyn sympathetic, and impressed by Ralph's kindly, honest face, he soon found himself telling them something of his difficulties, of the maze in which he found himself, of the snubs which Waters had administered. Ralph slapped himself with his whip, whistled, and gave other masculine signs of interest and sympathy. Evelyn looked from one to the other, amiably distressed in her well-fitting habit. After a long conversation, in which Evelyn disclosed that Ralph was possessed of the most extraordinary knowledge and experience in such matters, the two good-natured young people, seeing he was depressed and lonely, begged him to come and stay with them at Atherston the very next day, where he might discuss his affairs with Ralph, if so disposed, and take counsel with him. Dare accepted with the most genuine pleasure, and his speaking countenance was in a moment radiant with smiles. Was not the little Molly of the school feast their child, and was not Miss Dainecourt likewise staying with them? When his visitors departed, Dare took a turn at the rapiers, then opened the piano with the internal derangement, and sang to his own accompaniment a series of little confidential French songs, which would have made the hair of his ancestors stand on end, if painted hair could do such a thing. And the new squire, as he was already called, shrugged his shoulders and lowered his voice, and spread out his expressive rapid hands, and introduced to Vanden, one after another, some of those choice little ditties, French and English, which had made him such a favourite companion in Paris, so popular in a certain society in America. End of chapter 7.
Chapter 8 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Chumley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers.
Chapter 8.
Sir Charles!
Miss Dainecourt.
I fear, with a glance at the yellow back in his hand, I'm interrupting a studious hour, but—
Not in the least, I assure you, said Charles, shutting his novel. What is regarded as study by the feminine intellect is to the masculine merely relaxation. I was unbending over a book, that was all.
The process of unbending was being performed in the summer-house, whither he had retired after Evelyn and Ralph had started on their afternoon's ride to Vanden, in which he had refused to join.
"I thought I should find you here," continued Ruth, frankly. "I've been wishing to speak to you for several days, but you are, as a rule, so surrounded and encompassed on every side by Molly that I have not yet had an opportunity."
It had occurred to Charles once or twice during the last few days that Molly was occasionally rather in the way. Now he was sure of it. As Ruth appeared to hesitate, he pulled forward a rustic, contorted chair for her.
"No, thanks," she said. "I shall not long interrupt the unbending process. I only came to ask—"
"To ask?" repeated Charles, who got up as she was standing, and came and stood near her.
"You remember the first evening you were here?"
"I do."
"And what we spoke of at dinner?"
"Perfectly."
"I came to ask you how much you lent Raymond."
Ruth's clear, earnest eyes were fixed full upon him. At this moment Charles perceived Lady Mary at a little distance, propelling herself gently over the grass in the direction of the summer-house. In another second she perceived Charles and Ruth, and had turned precipitately, and hobbled away round the corner with surprising agility.
"Confound her!" inwardly ejaculated Charles.
"I wish to know how much you lent him," said Ruth again, as he did not answer, happily unconscious of what had been going on behind her back. "Only what I was well able to afford."
"And has he paid it back since?"
"I am sure he understood I should not expect him to pay it back at once."
"But he's had it 3 years."
Charles did not answer.
"I feel sure he is not able to pay it. Will you kindly tell me how much it was?"
"No, Miss Dacourt, I think not."
"Why not?"
"Because, excuse me, but I perceive that if I do, you will instantly wish to pay it."
"I do wish to pay it."
"I thought so." There was a short silence.
"I still wish it,"
said Ruth at last. Charles was silent. Her pertinacity annoyed and yet piqued him. Being unmarried, he was not accustomed to opposition from a woman. He had no intention of allowing her to pay her brother's debt, and he wished she would drop the subject gracefully, now that he had made that fact evident.
"Perhaps you don't know," continued Ruth, "that I am very well off."
As if he did not know it, as if Lady Mary had not casually mentioned Ruth's fortune several times in his hearing.
"Lady Dacourt left me 1,200 a year, and I have a little of my own besides. You may not be aware that I have £1,462 per annum."
"I am very glad to hear it."
"That is a large sum, you will observe."
"It is riches," assented Charles, "if your expenditure happens to be less."
"It does happen to be considerably less in my case."
"You are to be congratulated, yet I have always understood that society exacts great sacrifices from women in the sums they feel obliged to devote to dress."
"Dress is an interesting subject, and I should be delighted to hear your views on it another time. But we are talking of something else just at this moment."
"I beg your pardon," said Charles quickly, who did not quite like being brought back to the case in point. The truth was, I wished to turn your mind from what we were speaking of. I don't want you to count sovereigns into my hand. I really should dislike it very much."
"You intend me to think from that remark that it was a small sum,"
said Ruth, with unexpected shrewdness.
"I now feel sure it was a large one. It ought to be paid, and there's no one to do it but me. I know that what is firmness in a man is obstinacy in a woman, so do not on your side be too firm, or, who knows, you may arouse some of that obstinacy in me to which I should like to think myself superior."
"If," said Charles, with sudden eagerness, as if an idea had just struck him, "if I let you pay me this debt, will you on your side allow me to make a condition?"
"I should like to know the condition first."
"Of course. If I agree," Charles' light grey eyes had become keen and intent, "if I agree to receive payment at what I lent Dacourt 3 years ago, will you promise not to pay any other debt of his, or even to lend him money without the knowledge and approval of your relations?" Ruth considered for a few minutes.
"I have so few relations," she said at length, with rather a sad smile, "and they are all prejudiced against poor Raymond. I think I am the only friend he has left in the world. I'm afraid I could not promise that."
"Well," said Charles eagerly, "I won't insist on relations. I know enough of those thorns in the flesh myself. I will say instead, natural advisers." "Come, Miss Dacourt, you can't accuse me of firmness now."
"My natural advisers," repeated Ruth slowly. "I feel as if I ought to have natural advisers somewhere. But who are they? Where are they? I could not ask my sister or her husband for advice. I mean, I could not take it if I did. I should think I knew better myself. Uncle John? Evelyn? Lord Polesworth? Sir Charles, I'm afraid the truth is I have never asked for advice in my life. I have always tried to do what seemed best, without troubling to know what other people thought about it. But as I am anxious to yield gracefully, will you substitute the word friends for natural advisers? I hope and think I have friends whom I could trust."
"Friends, then, let it be," said Charles. "Now," holding out his hand, "do you promise never, etc., etc., without first consulting your friends?"
Ruth put her hand into his. "I do."
"That is right. How amiable we are both becoming. I suppose I must now inform you that £200 is the exact sum I lent your brother."
Ruth went back to the house, and a few minutes returned with a cheque in her hand. She held it towards Charles, who took it and put it in his pocket-book. "Thank you," she said with gratitude in her eyes and voice.
"'We've had a pitched battle,' said Charles, relapsing into his old indifferent manner. "'Neither of us has been actually defeated, for we never called out our reserves, which I felt would have been hardly fair on you. But we do not come forth with flying colours. I fear, from your air of elation, you actually believe you have been victorious.'
"'I agree with you that there has been no defeat,' replied Ruth. "'But I won't keep you any longer from your studies. I'm just going out driving with Lady Mary to have tea with the Thursbys.'
"'Mr. Acord, don't allow a natural and most pardonable vanity to delude you to such an extent. Don't go out driving, the victim of a false impression. If you will consider one moment—'
"'Not another moment,' replied Ruth.
"'Our bugles have sung truce, and I'm not going to put on my war paint again for any consideration. There comes the carriage,' as a distant rumbling was heard. "'I must not keep Lady Mary waiting.' And she was gone. Charles heard the carriage roll away again, and when half an hour later he sauntered back towards the house, he was surprised to see Lady Mary sitting in the drawing-room window.
"'What, not gone after all?'
he exclaimed, in a voice in which surprise was more predominant than pleasure.
"'No, Charles,' returned Lady Mary in her measured tones, looking slowly up at him over her gold-rimmed spectacles. "'I felt a slight return of my old enemy, and Miss Dancourt kindly undertook to make my excuses to Mrs. Thursby.'
No one knew what the old enemy was, or in what manner his mysterious assaults on Lady Mary were conducted, but it was an understood thing that she had private dealings with him, in which he could make himself very disagreeable.
"'Has Molly gone with her?'
"'No, Molly is making jam in the kitchen, I believe. Miss Dancourt most good-naturedly offered to take her with her, but—'
with a shake of the head—
"'the poor child's totally unrestrained appetites and lamentable self-will made her prefer to remain where she was.'
"'I'm afraid,' said Charles meditatively, as if the idea were entirely a novel one, "'Molly is getting a little spoiled among us. It is naturally new, of course, but there's no excuse for me.
There never is. There are, I confess, moments when I don't regard the child's immortal welfare sufficiently to make her present existence less enjoyable. What a round of gaiety Molly's life is! She flits from flower to flower, so to speak, from me to cook and the jam-pots, from the jam-pots to some fresh delight in the loft or in your society. Life is one long feast to Molly. Whatever that old impostor, the future, may have in store for her, at any rate, she's having a good time now.
There was a shade of regretful sadness in Charles's voice that ruffled his aunt.
"The child is being ruined," she said with resigned bitterness.
"Not a bit of it. I was spoiled as a child, and look at me."
"You are spoiled. I don't spoil you, but other people do. Society does. And the result is that you are so hard to please that I don't believe you will ever marry. You look for a perfection in others which is not to be found in yourself."
"I don't fancy I should appear to advantage side by side with perfection," said Charles, in his most careless manner, and he rose and wandered away into the garden.
He was irritated with Lady Mary, with her pleased looks during the last few days, with her annoying celerity that afternoon in the garden. It was all the more annoying because he was conscious that Ruth amused and interested him in no slight degree. She had the rare quality of being genuine. She stood for what she was, without effort or self-consciousness. Whether playful or serious, she was always real. Beneath her reserved and rather quiet manner, there lurked a piquant unconventionality. The mixture of earnestness and humour, which were so closely interwoven in her nature that he could never tell which would come uppermost, had a strange attraction for him. He had grown accustomed to watch for and try to provoke the sudden gleam of fun in the serious eyes, which always preceded a retort given with an air of the sweetest feminine meekness, which would make Ralph rub himself all over with glee, and tell Charles, chuckling, "You'd not get much change out of Ruth." If only she had not been asked to Atherstone on purpose to meet him, if only Lady Mary had not arranged it, if only Evelyn did not know it, if only Ralph had not guessed it, if only he himself had not seen it from the first instant. Ruth and Molly were the only two unconscious persons in the house.
"I wonder," said Charles to himself, "why people can't allow me to manage my own affairs. What a world it is for unmarried men with money. Why did I not marry 15 years ago, when every woman with a straight nose was an angel of light, when I felt a noble disregard for such minor details as character, mind, sympathy, if the hair and eyes were the right shade? Why did I not marry when I was out of favour with my father? when I was head over ears in debt, and when at least I could feel sure no one would marry me for my money. Molly, as that young lady came running towards him with lingering traces of jam upon her flushed countenance, you have arrived just in time. Uncle Charles was getting so dull without you. What have you been after all this time?
Cook and me have made 31 pots, and a little one,
said Molly, inserting a very sticky hand into Charles's. And your Mr. Brown helped. Cook told him to go along at first, which wasn't kind, was it? But he stayed all the same, and I skimmed with a big spoon, and she poured it in the pots. And if they aren't covered up with paper yet, if you want to see them. And oh, Uncle Charles, what do you think? Father and mother have come back from their ride, and that nice funny man who was at the school feast is coming here tomorrow, and I shall show him my guinea pigs. He said he wanted to see them very much.
Oh, he did he? When was that?
At the school feast.
Oh, with enthusiasm. He was so nice, Uncle Charles, so attentive, and getting things when you want them, and the wheel went over his foot when he was shaking hands, and he didn't mind a bit, and he filled our teapots for us. Ruth's big one, you know, that holds such a lot.
Oh, he filled the big teapot, did he?
Yes, and mine too, and then he helped us to unpack the dolls. He was so kind to me and Cousin Ruth.
Kind to Miss Dancourt, was he?
Yes, and when he went away, he ran and opened the gate for us. Oh, there comes Cousin Ruth back again in the carriage. I'll run and tell her he's coming. She will be glad.
Aunt Mary is right, said Charles, watching his niece disappear. Molly has formed a habit of expressing herself with unnecessary freedom. Decidedly, she is a little spoiled. End of chapter 8.
Chapter 9 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Chumley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 9. Dare arrived at Atherstone the following afternoon. Evelyn and Ralph, who had enlarged on the state of morbid depression of the lonely inhabitant of Vanden, were rather taken aback by the jaunty appearance of the sufferer when he appeared, overflowing with evident satisfaction and small talk, his face wreathed with smiles.
"He bears up wonderfully," said Charles aside to Ruth later in the evening, as Dare warbled a very discreet selection of his best songs after dinner. "No one knows better than myself that many a breaking heart beats beneath a smiling waistcoat. But unless we had been told beforehand, we should never have guessed it in his case."
Dare, who was looking at Ruth, and saw Charles go and sit down by her, brought his song to an abrupt conclusion, and made his way to her also.
"You also sing, Miss Dancourt?" he asked. "I'm sure from your face you sing."
"I do."
"Thank heaven," said Charles fervently. "I did you an injustice. I thought you were going to say a little. Every singing young lady I ever met, when asked that question, invariably replies, a little."
"I leave my friends to say that for me," said Ruth.
"Perhaps you yourself sing a little?" asked Dare, wishing Charles would leave Ruth's ball of wool alone.
"No," said Charles, "I have no tricks." And he rose and went off to the newspaper table. Dare's songs were all very well, but really his voice was nothing so very wonderful, and he was not much of an acquisition in other ways. Then Dare took his opportunity. He dropped into Charles' vacant chair. He wound wool, he wished to learn to knit. His inquiring mind craved for information respecting shooting stockings. He talked of music, of songs, Italian, French, and English, of American niggern melodies. Would Miss Dancourt sing? Might he accompany her? Ah, she preferred the simple old English ballads. He loved the simple old English ballads. And Ruth, nothing loath, sang, in her fresh, clear voice, one song after another, Dare accompanying her with rapid sympathy and ease. Charles put down his paper and moved slightly, so that he had a better view of the piano. Evelyn laid down her work and looked affectionately at Ruth.
"Exquisite," said Lady Mary from time to time, who had said the same of Lady Grace's wavering little soprano.
"You also sing duet? You sing duet?" eagerly inquired Dare, the music school creaking with his suppressed excitement, and without waiting for an answer, he began playing the opening chords of Greeting. The two voices rose and fell together, now soft, now triumphant, harmonizing as if they sung together for years. Dare's second was low, pathetic, and it blended at once with Ruth's clear young contralto. Charles wondered that the others should applaud when the duet was finished. Ruth's voice went best alone, in his opinion.
"And the cold blast?" asked Dare, immediately afterwards.
The cold blast was here a moment ago, turning the leaves over rapidly. You're not tired, Miss Daincourt?
Tired, replied Ruth, her eyes sparkling. It never tires me to sing. It rests me.
Ah, so it is with me. That is just how I feel, said Dare. To sing or to listen to the voice of what? Confound him, wondered Charles. Of another, said Dare. Ah, here it is.
And he pounced on another song, and lightly touched the opening chords.
Oh, wert thou in the cold blast, sang Ruth, fresh and sweet. I'd shelter thee, Dare assured her with manly fervour. He went on to say what he would do if he were monarch of the realm, affirming that the brightest jewel of his crown would be his queen.
Anyhow, he can't pronounce Scotch, Charles thought.
Would be his queen, Dare repeated, with subdued emotion and an upward glance at Ruth, which she was too much absorbed in the song to see, but which did not escape Charles.
Dare's dark, sentimental eyes spoke volumes of not sermons at that moment.
Oh, Uncle Charles,
whispered Molly, who'd been allowed to sit up about 2 hours beyond her nominal bedtime, at which hour she really felt disposed to retire.
Oh, Uncle Charles, the brightest jewel in his crown, don't you wish you and me could sing together like that?
Charles moved impatiently and took up his paper again. The evening passed all too quickly for Dare, who loved music and the sound of his own voice, and he'd almost forgotten, until Charles left him and Ralph alone together in the smoking room, that he had come to discuss his affairs with the latter.
"Dear me," said Evelyn, who had followed her cousin to her room after they had dispersed for the night, and was looking out of Ruth's window.
"There must be Charles walking up and down on the lawn. Well, now, how thoughtful he is to leave Mr. Dare and Ralph together. You know, Ruth, poor Mr. Dare's affairs are in a very bad way, and he's come to talk things over with my Ralph."
"I hope Ralph will make him put his cottages in order," said Ruth, with sudden interest, shaking back her hair from her shoulders.
"Do you think he will?"
"Whatever Ralph advises, will he be sure to be right," replied Evelyn, with the soft conviction of his infallibility, which caused her to be considered by most of Ralph's masculine friends an ideal wife.
"It is women without reasoning powers of any kind whom the nobler sex should be careful to marry if they wish to be regarded through life in this delightful way by their wives. Men not particularly heroic in themselves, who yet are anxious to pose as heroes in their domestic circle, should remember that the smallest modicum of common sense on the part of the worshipper will inevitably mar a happiness, the very existence of which depends entirely on a blind, unreasoning devotion. In middle life the absence of reason begins perhaps to be felt, but why in youth take thought for such a far-off morrow?"
"I hope he will," said Ruth, half to herself. "What an opportunity that man has, if he only sees it. There is so much to be done, and it is all in his hands."
"Yes, it's not entailed, but I don't think there is so very much," said Evelyn. "But then, so long as people are nice, I never care whether they are rich or poor. That is the first question I ask when people come into the neighbourhood. Are they really nice?
Dear me, Ruth, what beautiful hair you have, and mine coming off so. And talking of hair, did you ever see anything like Mr. Dare's? Somebody must really speak to him about it. If he would keep his hand still and not talk so quick and let his hair grow a little, I really think he would not look so like a foreigner. I don't suppose he minds looking like one."
"My dear!"
"His mother was a Frenchwoman, wasn't she? I'm sure I have heard so 50 times since his uncle died."
"And if she was," said Evelyn reprovingly, "is not that an extra reason for his giving up anything that will remind people of it? And we ought to try and forget it, Ruth, and behave just the same to him as if she'd been an Englishwoman."
"I wonder if he's a Roman Catholic. Ask him."
"I hope he's not," continued Evelyn, taking up her candle to go. "We never had one to stay in the house before.
I don't mean,"
catching a glimpse of Ruth's face, "that Catholics are, well, I don't mean that. But still, you know, one would not like to make great friends with a Catholic, would one, Ruth? And he's so nice and so amusing that I do hope, as he's going to be a neighbour, he is a Protestant."
And after a few more remarks of about the same calibre from Evelyn, the two cousins kissed and parted for the night.
"Will he do it?" said Ruth to herself when she was alone. "Has he character enough, and perseverance enough, and money enough? Oh, I wish Uncle John would talk to him."
Ruth was not aware that one word from herself would have more weight with a man like Dare than any number from an angel of heaven, if that angel were of the masculine gender. If on the other side of the house Dare could have known how earnestly Ruth was thinking about him, he would not have been surprised, for he was not without experience, but he would have felt immensely flattered. Vanden lay in a distant part of Mr. Albin's parish, and a perpetual curate had charge of the district. Mr. Albin consequently seldom went there, but on the few occasions when Ruth had accompanied him in his periodical visits, she had seen enough. Who cares for a recital of what she saw? Misery and want are so common. We can see them for ourselves any day. In Ruth's heart a great indignation had kindled against old Mr. Dare of Vanden, who was inaccessible as a ghost in his own house, haunting the same rooms, but never to be found when Mr. Albin called upon him to put things before him in their true light. And when Mr. Dare descended to the Vanden vault, all Mr. Albin's interest, and consequently a good deal of Ruth's, had centred in the new heir, who was so difficult to find, and who ultimately turned up from the other end of nowhere, just when people were beginning to despair of his ever turning up at all. And now that he had come, would he make the crooked straight? Would the new broom sweep it clean? Ruth recalled the new broom's brown, handsome face, with the eager eyes and raised eyebrows, and involuntarily shook her head. It is difficult to be an impartial judge of anyone with a feeling for music and a pathetic tenor voice, but the face she called to mind did not inspire her with confidence. It was kindly, amiable, pleasant. But was it strong? In other words, was it not a trifle weak? She found herself comparing it with another, a thin, reserved face, with keen, light eyes and a firm mouth, a mouth with a cigar in it at that moment on the lawn. The comparison, however, did not help her meditations much, being decidedly prejudicial to the new broom. And the faint chime of the clock on the dressing-table, breaking in on them at the same moment, she dismissed them for the night, and proceeded to busy herself putting to bed her various little articles of jewellery, before betaking herself there also. Any doubts entertained by Evelyn about Dare's religious views were completely set at rest the following morning, which happened to be a Sunday. He appeared at breakfast in a black frock-coat, the splendour of which quite threw Ralph's ancient Sunday garment into the shade. He wore also a chastened, decorous aspect, which seemed unfamiliar to his mobile face, and rather ill-suited to it. After breakfast he inquired when service would be, and expressed a wish to attend it. He brought down a high hat and an enormous prayer-book, and figured with them in the garden. "Who is going to Greenacre, and who is going to Slumberley?" called out Ralph from the smoking-room window. "Because if any of you are going to foot it to Slumberley, you'd better be starting. Which are you going to, Charles?" "I'm going where Molly goes. Which is it to be, Molly?"
"Slumberley," said Molly with decision, "because it's the shortest sermon, and I want to see the little foal in Brown's Field."
"Slumberley be it," said Charles.
"Now, Miss Daincourt," as Ruth appeared, "which church are you going to support? Greenacre, which is close in more senses than one, where they never open the windows, and the clergyman preaches for an hour, or Slumberley, shady, airy, cool, lying past a meadow with a foal in it? If I may offer that as any inducement, Molly and I are intended to patronise Slumberley."
Ruth said she would do the same.
"Now, Dare, you would be able to decide whether Greenacre, with a little fat tower, or Slumberley, with a beautiful tall steeple, suits your religious views best."
"I will also go to Slumberley," said Dare, without a moment's hesitation.
"I thought so. I suppose," to Ralph and Evelyn, "you are going to Greenacre with Aunt Mary? Tell her I have gone to church, will you? It will cheer her up. Sunday is a very depressing day with her, I know. She thinks of all she has done in the week, preparatory to doing a little more on Monday. Good-bye. Now then, Molly, have you got your prayer-book? Miss Daincourt, I don't see yours anywhere. Oh, there it is. No, don't let Dare carry it for you. Give it to me. He will have enough to do, poor fellow, to travel with his own. Come, Molly. Is Vic chained up? Yes, I can hear him howling. The craving for church privileges of that dumb animal, Miss Daincourt, is an example to us Christians. Molly, have you got your penny? Miss Daincourt, can I accommodate you with a threepenny bit? Now, are we all ready to start?"
"When this outburst of eloquence has subsided," said Ruth, "the audience will be happy to move on." And so they started across the fields,
where the grass was already springing faint and green after the haymaking. There was a fresh wandering air which fluttered the ribbons in Molly's hat as she danced on ahead, frisking in her short white skirt beside her uncle, her hand in his. Charles was the essence of wit to Molly, with his grave face that so seldom smiled, and the twinkle in the kind eyes that always went before those wonderful, delightful jokes which he alone could make. Sometimes, as she laughed, she looked back at Ruth and Dare, half a field behind, in pity at what they were missing.
"Shall we wait and tell them that story, Uncle Charles?"
"No, Molly, I dare say he's telling her another which is just as good."
"I don't think he knows any like yours."
"Some people like the old, old story best."
"Do I know the old, old one, Uncle Charles?"
"No, Molly."
"Can you tell it?"
"No, I've never been able to tell that particular story."
"And do you really think he's telling it to her now?"
With a backward glance. "Not at this moment. It's no good running back. He's only thinking about it now. He'd tell it to her in about a month or 6 weeks' time."
"I hope I shall be there when he tells it."
"I hope you may, but I don't think it is likely. And now, Molly, set your hat straight and leave off jumping. I never jump when I go to church with Aunt Mary. Quietly now, for there's the church, and Mr. Elwood's looking out of the window." Dare, meanwhile, walking with Ruth, caught sight of the church and ditch gate with heartfelt regret. The stretches of sunny meadowland, the faint glamour of church bells, the pale, refined face beside him, had each individually and all three together appealed to his imagination, always vivid when he himself was concerned. He suddenly felt as if a great gulf had fixed itself, without any will of his own, between his old, easy-going life and the new existence that was opening out before him. He had crossed from the old to the new without any perception of such a gulf, and now, as he looked back, it seemed to yawn between him and all that hitherto he had been. He did not care to look back, so he looked forward. He felt as if he were the central figure. When was he not a central figure? In a new drama. He was fond of acting, on and off the stage, and now he seemed to be playing a new part, in which he was not yet thoroughly at ease, but which he rather suspected would become him exceedingly well. It amused him to see himself going to church, to hear himself conversing on flowers and music with a young English girl. The idea that he was rapidly falling in love was specially delightful. He called himself a vieux scélérat, and watched the progress of feelings which he felt did him credit with extreme satisfaction. He and Ruth arrived at the church porch all too soon for Dare, and though he had the pleasure of sitting on one side of her during the service, he would have preferred that Charles, of whom he felt a vague distrust, had not happened to be on the other. End of chapter 9.
Chapter 10 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Chumley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 10.
"My dear,"
said Mrs. Elwin to her husband that morning, as they started for church across the glebe,
"if any of the Atherston party are in church, as they ought to be, for I hear from Mrs. Smith that they are not at all regular at Greenacre, only went once last Sunday, and then late, I shall just tell Ruth that she is to come back to me tomorrow. A few days won't make any difference to her, and it will fit in so nicely her coming back the day you go to the palace. After all I've done for Ruth, new curtains to her room and the piano tuned and everything, I don't think she would like to stay there with friends, and me all by myself, without a creature to speak to. Ruth may only be a niece by marriage, but she will see in a moment." And in fact, she did. When Mrs. Elwin took her aside after church and explained the case in the all-pervading whisper for which she had apparently taken out a patent, Ruth could not grasp any reason why she should return to Slumberley 3 days before the time, but she saw at once that return she must if Mrs. Elwin chose to demand it. And so she yielded with a good grace, and sent Mrs. Elwin back smiling to the lych gate, where Mr. Elwin and Mabel Thursby were talking with Dare and Molly, while Charles interviewed the village policeman at a little distance.
"No news of the tramp?"
said Charles, meeting Ruth at the gate, and they started homeward in different order to that in which they had come, in spite of the great effort at the last moment on the part of Dare, who thought the old way was better.
"The policeman has seen nothing of him. He's gone off to past his new, I expect."
"I hope he has."
"Mrs. Elwin does not want you to leave Atherston tomorrow, does she?"
I'm sorry to say she does.
But you won't go.
I must not only go, but I must do it as soon as I liked it.
I hope Evelyn won't allow it.
While I'm living with Mrs. Alwyn, I'm bound to do what she likes in small things.
Ah.
I should have thought, Sir Charles, that this particularly feminine and submissive sentiment would have met with your approval.
It does, said Charles hastily. Only, after the stubborn rigidity of your, shall I say, your weekday character, especially as regards money, this softened Sabbath mood took me by surprise for a moment.
You should see me at Slumberley, said Ruth, with a smile half sad, half humorous. You should see me tying up Uncle John's flowers, or holding Aunt Fanny's wools. Nothing more entirely feminine and young ladylike can be imagined.
It must be a great change after living with a woman like Lady Dancourt, to whose house I often went years ago when our son was living, to come to a place like Slumberley.
It is a great change. I'm ashamed to say how much I felt it at first. I don't know how to express it, but everything down here seems so small and local and hard and fast.
I know, said Charles gently, and they walked on in silence.
And yet, he said at last, it seems to me, and I should have thought you would have felt the same, that life is very small, very narrow, and circumscribed everywhere,
though perhaps more obviously so in Cranford's and Shumberley's.
I've seen a good deal during the last 15 years. I've mixed with many sorts and conditions of men, but in no class or grade of society have I yet found independent men and women. The groove is as narrow in one class as in another, though in some it is better concealed. I sometimes feel as if I were walking in a ballroom full of people all dancing the lancers. There are different sets, of course, fashionable, political, artistic, but the people in them are all crossing over, all advancing and retiring with the same apparent aimlessness, or setting to partners.
There is occasionally an aim in that.
Charles smiled grimly.
They follow the music in that as in everything else. You go away for 10 years, still find them on your return, going through the same figures to new tunes.
I wonder if there are any people anywhere in the world who stand on their own feet and think and act for themselves, who don't set their watches by other people's, who don't live and marry and die by rote, expecting to go straight up to heaven by rote afterwards.
I believe there are such people, said Ruth earnestly. I've had glimpses of them, but the real ones look like the shadows, and the shadows like the real ones, and we miss them in the crowd.
Or one thinks one finds them, and they turn out only clever imitations after all.
These days there is a mania for shamming originality of some kind. I'm always imagining people I meet are real and not shadows, until one day I unintentionally put my hand through them and find out my mistake. I'm getting tired of being taken in.
And some day you will get tired of being cynical.
I'm very much obliged to you for your hopeful view of my future. You evidently imagine that I have gone in for the fashionable creed of the young man of the present day. I'm not young enough to take pleasure in high collars and cheap cynicism, Miss Dancourt. Cynical people are never disappointed in others, as I so often am, because they expect the worst. In theory, I respect and admire my fellow creatures, but they continually exasperate me because they won't allow me to do so in real life. I have still, I blush to own it, a lingering respect for women, though they have taken pains to show me, time after time, what a fool I am for such a weakness.
Charles looked intently at Ruth. Women are so terribly apt in handling any subject to make it personal. Would she fire up, or would she, like so many women, join in abuse of her own sex? She did neither. She was looking straight in front of her, absently watching the figures of Dare and Molly in the next field. Then she turned her grave, thoughtful glance towards him.
"I think respect is never weakness," she said. "It is a sign of strength, even when it is misplaced. There's not much to admire in cunning people who are never taken in. The best people I have known, the people whom it did me good to be with, have been those who respected others and themselves. Do not be in too great a hurry to get rid of any little fragment that still remains. You may want it when it is gone."
Charles's apathetic face had become strangely earnest. There was a keen, searching look in his tired, restless eyes. He was about to make some answer, when he suddenly became aware of Dare and Molly sitting perched on a gate close at hand, waiting for them.
Never had he perceived Molly's little brown face with less pleasure than at that moment. She scrambled down with a noble disregard of appearances, and tried to take his hand. But it was coolly withdrawn. Charles fell behind on some pretence of fastening the gate. Molly had to content herself with Ruth's and Dare's society for the remainder of the walk. Ruth had almost forgotten, until Molly suggested at luncheon a picnic for the following day, that she was returning to Slumberly on Monday morning, and when she made the fact known, Ralph had to be hushed several times by Evelyn for muttering opinions behind the sirloin respecting Mrs. Albin, which Evelyn seemed to have heard before, and to consider unsuited to the ears of that lady's niece.
"But if you go away, Cousin Ruth, we can't have the picnic, can we, Uncle Charles?"
"Impossible, Molly. Rather bread and butter at home than a mixed biscuit in the open air without Miss Daincourt." "Is Mrs. Albin suffering?" asked Lady Mary, politely, down the table. Ruth explained that she was not in ill health, but that she did wish to be left alone, and Ralph was hushed again. Lady Mary was annoyed, or, more properly speaking, she was moved in the spirit, which in a churchwoman seems to be the same thing as annoyance in the unregenerate or unorthodox mind. She regretted Ruth's departure more than anyone, except perhaps Ruth herself. She watched the girl very narrowly, and she'd seen nothing to make her alter the opinion she had formed of her. Indeed, she was inclined to advance beyond it. Even she could not suspect that Ruth had played her cards well, although she would have aided and abetted her in any way in her power if Ruth had shown the slightest consciousness of holding cards at all, or been desirous of playing them. Her frank yet reserved manner, her distinguished appearance, her sense of humour, which Lady Mary did not understand, but which she perceived others did, and the quiet savoir-faire of her treatment of Dare's advances, all enhanced her greatly in the eyes of her would-be aunt. She bade her good-bye with genuine regret, the only person who bore her departure without a shade of compunction being Dare, who stood by the carriage till the last moment, assuring Ruth that he hoped to come over to the rectory very shortly, while Charles and Molly held the gate open meanwhile at the end of the short drive. "I know that Frenchman means business," said Lady Mary wrathfully to herself, as she watched the scene from the garden. Her mind, from the very severity of its tension, was liable to occasional lapses of this painful kind, from the spiritual and ecclesiastical to the mundane and transitory. "I saw it directly he came into the house, and with his opportunities, and living within a stone's throw, I should not wonder that he were to succeed. Any man would fetch a fancy price at Slumberly, and the most fastidious woman in the world ceases to be critical if she is reduced to the proper state of dullness. He is handsome, too, in his foreign way. But she does not like him now. She is inclined to like Charles, though she does not know it. There is an attraction between the two. I knew there would be. And he likes her. Oh, what fools men are! He will go away, and Dare, on the contrary, will ride over to Slumberly every day. By the time he is engaged to her, Charles will see her again, and find out that he is in love with her himself. Oh, the folly, the density of unmarried men! And indeed, with a sudden recollection of the deceased Mr. Cunningham, of the whole race of them! But of all men I've ever known, I really think the most provoking is Charles." "Musing?" inquired her nephew, sauntering up to her. "I was thinking that we have just lost the pleasantest person of our little party," said Lady Mary, viciously seizing up her work. "I am still here," suggested Charles, by way of consolation. "I don't start for Norway in Wyndham's yacht for 3 days to come."
"Do you mean to say you are going to Norway?"
"I forget whether it was to be Norway, but I know I'm booked to go yachting somewhere. It's Wyndham's new toy. He paid through the parental nose for it, and he made me promise in London to go with him on his first cruise. I believe a very charming Miss Wyndham is to be of the party."
"And how long, pray, are you going to yacht with Miss Wyndham?"
"It is with her brother I propose to go. I thought I'd explained that before. I shall probably cruise about, let me see, for 3 weeks or so, till the grouse shooting begins. Then I am due into Scotland at the Hope Actons, and several other places." Lady Mary laid down her work and rose to her feet, her thin hand closing tightly over the silver crook of her stick.
"Charles," she said, in a voice trembling with anger, looking him full in the face, "you are a fool!"
And she passed him without another word,
and hobbled away rapidly into the house.
"Am I?"
said Charles, half aloud to himself, when the last fold of her garment had been twitched out of sight through the window.
"Am I?"
"Molly," with great gravity, as Molly appeared. "Yes, you may sit on my knee, but don't wriggle.
Molly, what is a fool?"
"I think it's Racker, only worse," said Molly. "Uncle Charles, Mr. Dare is going away too. His dog-cart has just come into the yard."
"Has it? I hope he won't keep it waiting."
"You're not going away, are you?"
"Not for 3 days more."
"Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Why, they will be gone in a moment."
But to Charles they seemed 3 very long days indeed. He was annoyed with himself for having made so many engagements before he left London. At the time there did not seem anything better to be done, and he supposed he must go somewhere. But now he thought he would have liked to stay on at Atherston, though he would not have said so to Lady Mary for worlds. He was tired of rushing up and down. He was not so fond of yachting, after all, and he remembered that he had been many times to Norway. "I would get out of it if I could," he said to Lady Mary on the last morning, "and of this blue serge suit, too. You should see Miss Wyndham in blue serge. But it is not a question of pleasure, but of principle. I don't like to throw over Wyndham at the last moment, after what you said when I failed the Hope Actons last year. Twins could not feel more exactly together than you and I do where a principle is involved. I see you are about to advise me to keep my engagement. Do not trouble to do so. I am going to Portsmouth by the midday train. Brown is at this moment packing my telescope and lifebelt." End of chapter 10.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.